Hello and welcome to the launch of the Global Civil Society Yearbook. It's the sixth in the series. I'm going to hold it up for you there to see, and I think there are some on sale outside if you'd like some. Let me introduce myself first. My name is Kirsty Lang. I'm a presenter on BBC World and BBC 4's nightly news programme, which is also called The World. Before that, I was at Channel 4 News and was for many years a foreign correspondent for the BBC and the Sunday Times. I was also a student here at the LSE and attended many a rabble-rousing debate in this very theatre, so it's great to be back. I'm here to introduce this evening's discussion and our speakers. Unfortunately, Tariq Ramadan couldn't come. He's been called away on an urgent political mission, not quite sure what, but he's very, very sorry that he could not be here. However, we still have our three other speakers, each of whom will talk for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we're going to open the floor to questions at the end. Probably leave about half an hour for that, so you'll have plenty of time to join in. As many of you may know, the aim of the research into global civil society is to map globalization from below, to find the principal actors, to examine how they organise themselves and to find links between civil society on the one hand and problems of global security and political economy on the other. Many of the case studies which are done as part of that research have been commissioned especially for the yearbook. Now, the theme of tonight's debate is delegitimising violence in a global era. It's pretty topical given the litany of bloodshed that dominates our daily news bulletins. Suicide bombings, airstrikes, hostages, collateral damage and proportionate response all pepper the lexicon of 21st century politics. This year's book asks, what is the relationship between civil society and violence? Is it ever justified for non-state actors to use violence? And if so, can legal and moral limits be imposed? What can be learnt from Western and Islamic traditions about the complex relationship between violence, civil society, and legitimacy? It was inspired by Mary Calder and Heber Rauf Ezzat's exploration of the traditions of jihad and just war, how these two schools of thought may hold the seeds of greater global civility. And it's a discussion with which Martin Olbro engages in the introduction to the yearbook. So, to address these issues tonight, we have the three yearbook authors. I should also add that the contents of the yearbook and the participants here tonight in this discussion are testimony to the diversity of people involved, not just scholars in the book, but also political activists, NGOs, journalists, and so on. And I'd also like to mention that this was made possible by collaboration with Cairo University and a range of other organisations. Well, let me introduce tonight's speakers. Martin Olbro will speak first. He's a sociologist whose books include Max Weber's Construction of Social Theory, Do Organizations Have Feelings? Sociology, the Basics, and the prize-winning The Global Age. Formerly, he was founder-editor of the journal International Sociology, president of the British Sociological Association, and chair of the sociology panel for the British University's research assessment exercise. Emeritus professor of the University of Wales, he is currently a visiting fellow in the Centre for the Study of Global Governance, and he's an editor-in-chief of Global Civil Society 2006-07. Heber Rauf Ezzat teaches political theory at the Department of Political Science, Cairo University. She's a coordinator of the Civil Society Programme at the Centre for Political Research at Cairo University and editor of the Arabic version of the Global Civil Society Yearbook, which will be published by the CPRS in conjunction with LSE's Centre for the Study of Global Governance. She's published two books in Arabic on women, politics, morality in Islam, and she's contributed chapters on women, secularism, democracy, and human rights from an Islamic perspective to a wide variety of English language publications. She's also a member of the C100 initiative by the World Economic Forum for Islamic Western Understanding. And finally, Mary Calder, known to many of you here, I'm sure, is a professor of global governance at LSE and co-director of the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at LSE. She's written widely on security issues and on democracy and civil society. Her recent books include Global Civil Society, An Answer to War, New and Old Wars, Organised Violence in a Global Era, and most recently she co-edited A Human Security Doctrine for Europe. Mary was a founder member of European Nuclear Disarmament End and a founder and co-chair of the Helsinki Citizens Assembly. And she's also convener of the study group on European security capabilities established at the request of Javier Solana. Well, before I hand over to Martin, just one final announcement, which is that I've been told to inform you that this event will be recorded and made available online for public consumption as a podcast on the LSE website.
Thank you very much, Kirsty, and thank you, the team of Global Civil Society, because it was only this year I was drafted into this distinguished company. I think I should thank particularly Marlies Glacius, because it was because she was on maternity leave that I actually came in here. And this was even before the new employment legislation. Employers here, watch out. I mean, in future, you'll have no problem covering maternity leave. You've got all these retired people out there who can now be asked to take on the same work, clearly. I don't know whether violence is something where you can begin lightheartedly, and but on the other hand, I couldn't help laughing at the light, the London light, as I walked here. I don't know if anyone saw the placards for that, which was Ticket Inspector Throttles Fare Dodger. quite a good example, I think, of the ambiguities of violence in a civil society, in the sense that the ambiguity surrounds the duties and functions of the ticket inspector. Is the ticket inspector, by virtue of his semi-state employment, is he warranted in acting as an agent of state violence? I want today to talk about violence and civility, because we've chosen, with the yearbook this year, to use civility rather than civil society in the heading. And that, I think, is really quite a significant move. For one thing, it's quite dangerous because it picks up a very long tradition in European, in Western thought about the idea of civility. And I want to say something about that because I want, I think, to try and disabuse some of you possibly, but certainly out there, a lot of people who believe that the idea of civility in the Western tradition was a form of conceptual imperialism, that it was purely Western-oriented and left no room for civilization in general or civilizations outside the West. There was a text on the web the other day. Somebody sent in a query on what is called classroomtools.com. I don't know whether anyone knows it. It's quite a useful website. And the query was, where on earth does this quotation come from? I disagree with what you have to say, but we'll fight to the death to protect your right to say it. And Classroom Tools then sent out a message to all their correspondents, and there's a very long list and a very interesting discussion. Well, I want to ask here, actually, is there anyone here who will refuse to fight for me to say the things here I want to say? Is there anyone here who will refuse to fight for me for what I'm going to say? One, two, three, four. Quite a small minority. A small minority, I would say, of enlightened people. Because there is no way you should come and fight for me if I say something stupid. There's no way, in fact, in which I want to claim the right to say anything under any circumstances anywhere. And in actual fact, when you start to look at this quotation, you start to find more and more problems with it. I mean, it gets used all the time. A wonderful example for us, we could almost have used it as a text for today, and this was the Guardian leader on Saturday. I don't know whether anyone saw that. It was Islam and free speech. And here, it was called Common Sense and Sensibilities. And here, we have quoted so-called Voltaire's maxim, I disagree with what you say, but will defend to the death your right to say it. Something different, in other words, from the quotation that went out on the web, because there's no mention here of fighting. It says, I will defend. The popular version of this is you fight for rights. But in actual fact, Voltaire is imputed to have said, I will defend your right. In other words, if somebody attacks, I will defend. In actual fact, even the Guardian doesn't get the quote quite right. The quote is actually, I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. It's I disapprove, not I disagree. But the interesting thing about that quote, and it's a very famous one, and of course one which goes to the heart of so many of the issues of rights and fighting, defending, whether one takes initiatives to defend rights, whether one can extend rights elsewhere. The whole point is that Voltaire didn't say it. He didn't even write it. In fact, it's a summary by somebody who wrote an account called The Friends of Voltaire in 1909. And it was an account of Voltaire's reaction to a friend of his, a close friend of his, somebody he corresponded with for 30 years, a young protege. And it was Voltaire's response when this young man, Helvetius, had his book burned by order of the French government. And the Pope had denounced him. In fact, the whole world was denouncing him. And so Voltaire stood up for his friend, but he didn't say this. This is the summary of his attitude. So we've got this statement which has gone into the canon of so much Western thinking about rights, but is in actual fact a commentator's gloss on what Voltaire was saying. In actual fact, I don't think it would make much sense to pursue it very far. And I don't know whether anyone here knows Avram Grumer. Anyone know Avram Grumer? Have you ever come across someone called Avram Grumer? No. He's a New York web artist. And has his own website. And Avram Grumer has got this version. I may disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to misattribute this quote to Voltaire. May 2000, and I can tell you there are something like already, I think it's 3,600 sites which include this quote from Grumer as Grumer's. It's a very good quote indeed, because I think it reduces to absurdity the whole issue of fighting for rights. No one's got a right to misquote Voltaire. No one's going to fight for Voltaire. The whole use of rights in this context is almost hysterical. And it is used, of course, to underpin violence, time and again. Voltaire had a very personal interest in being offended. His own book was being burned at the same time as Helvetius' book was being burned. And if I had been him, I too would have gone shoulder to shoulder. But that does not indicate some general principle that wherever free speech is restricted anywhere in the world, that somehow or other there is an obligation on all of us to go out and defend it. No, very strictly, it's related to the people you know, the people you love, the people you respect, and the people you belong to. The question of rights, then, is always relative to the social unit to which you belong. Now, I'm wanting to make out a case, actually, that the Enlightenment was not as aggressive as we sometimes in the 20th century have made it out to be. There's been, of course, a reaction against the Enlightenment, an attempt to see it as a kind of precursor to all that's bad in the 20th century. Voltaire as a kind of precursor for the Holocaust. And some accounts have I think, done violence to history in this respect. Now, the notions of civility that were current at the time were promoted in both France and in England, were ones which set the civilized world against what was known as barbarity. But it didn't set Europe against the rest of the world. On the contrary. And if we take the prime representative in England at the time of, shall we say, a kind of jaundiced enlightenment, Samuel Johnson, and refer to his dictionary, which became a kind of legislative account of concepts at that time, you'll find civility at length quoted, used for a whole range of meanings. Now, I read the web, but I also go, I read funny things like the original version of that dictionary. It's quite hard to get hold of. But if you take his definition of civil, which is the basis of his definition of civility, this is what it means. At that time, relating to the community, relating to any man as a member of a community, not in anarchy, not wild, not without rule, not ecclesiastical, as the ecclesiastical courts, he glosses this, are controlled by the civil, not natural, not military, not criminal, civilized and not barbarous. It's a pretty broad definition, but it's one he's capable of using in the notion of civility. He then goes on to talk in terms of civility, and this is how he defines it. Civility, freedom from barbarity, the state of being civilized. Rule of decency, practice of politeness. No more than that. Johnson hated colonialism. He hated slavery. He could be regarded as one of the first anti-Americans, actually. He once said he respected all men, and then he thought, except Americans. He was the man who said that, you know, these great advocates of liberty are the drivers of slaves. Voltaire himself had as his servant a freed slave all his life. He sent his freed slave to school. He spent £3,000 for 5 years on his schooling from the age of 21 to 26. And young Francis Barber then got married. He stayed with Johnson his whole life. And when Johnson died, he left Francis Barber £70 a year, a substantial amount. And Francis Barber had six children, and his descendants are still with us in the Midlands today. It's a fascinating story. Here you have this Tory gentleman, apparently the representative of Old England, who hates colonialism, and he promotes an idea of civility which is cross-cultural, cross-national. You do find all kinds of prejudices there, of course. But one interesting thing is, he is, for instance, challenged at one time on why he's so interested in Turkey. And he said, Turkey is fascinating because we have the only two cultures which are interesting, the Christian and the Mohammedan. And then he was asked, well, what about the Chinese? He said, no, I'm not. I don't think the Chinese. The Chinese, they haven't moved at all. He acknowledged the Great Wall of China was the greatest contribution to human civilization, but the Chinese were stuck. This was an 18th century prejudice, plenty of 18th century prejudices. What I'm wanting to stress is the idea of civility has its roots in what one author has called a minimalist universalism. A minimalist universalism. That is, not a universalism which says the whole world should work to and abide by certain key values. No. A minimalist universalism is one which says, look, there are in fact some things in the world which hold us together, some things where human beings can relate to each other. Reason is one. Reason is something which all human beings possess. And those who've had the advantages of wealth, they can attain higher civilization. He's quite clear on this. He's quite clear, too, that those who have the advantages of wealth can abuse them grossly and, in fact, enslave those in other societies. He regards the whole history of colonialism as a complete disaster. It's a complete disaster for the violence that it's done to human beings in other parts of the world. Civility, then, I make the case for, is a universal, but one where we can't see it as necessarily fulfilled everywhere and at all times. It's also a universal that people can fall short on. Civility is the basis of a universal civilization, which is not simply technology and not simply material things, and does cross boundaries between cultures. It's one of the ways in which we can relate to other people in other societies. There are other ways we can relate to them, and the yearbook suggests many. We can do it through, of course, developed institutions. We can do it also by collaborating on challenges that address us all, challenges which result in our committing ourselves to global goals which cross cultural boundaries. But I think the notion of civility is an additional notion to those of institutions and those of agreement on global goals. It's one I'm asking us to take seriously. The Global Civil Society Yearbook this year takes it seriously. And I'm sure in what you hear from Heber and Mary, you'll find that it's something to take seriously, not just in Europe, not just United States, not just in Islam, but everywhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin. Heber will now speak.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. I feel very much indebted to Mary and Dr. Martin Cho and the head of our panel for allowing me to talk to this gathering. And Mary asked me this morning, what are you going to talk about? Because we wrote the chapter, the introductory chapter together, and we were supposed to split the mission of exposing the ideas that we discussed. And I said to her, I will talk about you. So I will talk actually about the experience of writing a chapter with Mary. We have had long discussions now for about 3 years regarding different aspects of civility and global civil society and globalization, etc. Me coming from not so different background, because at the end of the day, the liberal education and the academia share in different parts of the world the same concepts, sort of methodological background and access to the same jargon of terms and same ideas. But because we might look at things from different angles, and amazingly, we found out that we can look at different things from the same angle. So we built up over the last 3 years an amazing friendship. And I think that what fascinated us, both of us, how lucid and how easy we could write a chapter together. We expected that we will disagree, that we will argue, that some of the ideas will be subject to controversy, but actually what happened was very, very interesting. Those who reviewed the chapter, and you'll find the chapter in the edition, we have basically three parts, methodological considerations regarding issues of violence and civility, and then we move to comparing the two traditions of jihad and of just war in the Western tradition, and then we move to developing a notion of preemptive civility to counter the notion of preemptive war. Some of those who read the draft at the beginning said, Heba did some very interesting things writing about jihad. Actually, all the things written about jihad in the chapter are written by Mary. And this is the truth, the whole truth. Actually, I added some remarks here and there on some of the issues of jihad from a political science a science background, not from an Islamist background, and I also added a sentence or two regarding some Jewish notions and a reference by Michael Walzer on Jewish political thought. So it was a fascinating, actually, experience. And to just summarize some of the concerns, some of the issues we were discussing, I would like to talk about the journey of developing ideas. The chapter is actually not an outcome of debates and discussions for this year, but it actually is an outcome of the debates and discussions between me and Mary and the group of the Global Civil Society Yearbook for the past 3 years. And we spotted somehow at the very early beginning of cooperation between the Center for Global Governance and the Center for Political Research and Studies at Cairo University that when we talk about global civil society, we focus on what civil society is about. We focus about, is there anything called civil society in the first place, and is there a global civil society? What is globalization? How does this associative nature of the global civil society function? But we rarely stop in front of the issue of civility. What is civil about global civil society? And is the use of force a taboo in the global civil society and its different spheres, or is global civil society and its different actors in need sometimes to debate a specific limited, negotiated, well agreed upon degree of use of force somehow to defend the causes of civility that the global civil society and any civil society actually is defending and aiming to preserve in the first place. So is pacifism something that we cannot touch? Is it a taboo? Or can global civil society somehow, vis-a-vis the excessive use of force, use some of its own assets? And in what way? And in what civil way can it use force to combat the uncivil use of force, etc.? And of course, the first issue that was at stake and that was discussed in the last yearbook and in this yearbook as well was debating the state in the first place. Because if the modern deal was that the state would have monopoly over the use of power and that the society would not have that access, what did the state do with that monopoly? The promise of modernity was more peace, less civil unrests and less civil wars. We had nuclear wars and we had all the things that the critics of modernity talk about. This is an issue that we need to discuss further. How far are we as citizens supposed to give in to that agreement historically where one partner in the agreement did not at all fulfill the promise and millions of people paid the price? We also wanted to debate the issue of violence and civility in terms of language. If civil society is a place, is a space, is a location for associative activities, civil and campaigning and coming together and allowing freedoms to be protected and to be respected, freedom of speech, freedom of association, and all civil liberties, it's also about language. And who has the monopoly over language to define what action is civilized and what is not? Again, the state comes in to define and to decide that a suicide bombing somewhere is much more brutal, much more uncivil than a bomb dropped by a military force belonging to a country devastating cities. So if we agree that both actions actually, even from an Islamic perspective, have the same weight of a crime against humanity, even if it addresses just one person or addresses millions of people, the sort of immorality of the use of violence without any legitimate reason is the same. How can we then go from there to talk about the right of different civil societies to take back the legitimacy that it gave to the state, and in what form are we to negotiate the use of force and the monopoly of the state? A third issue, and here comes, as I said before, the language, the negotiation dimension of negotiating war and peace, negotiating civility and incivility in a way between civil society and between the state. The third issue that we were interested in was also the context of the use of force and the context of war or uncivil wars or whatever, which is the urban space. How far is the urban space? Was the urban space seen in thought, in Western thought, as the embedding notions of civility, etiquette, ways of dealing with negotiating difference in a peaceful manner, and how far did the urban space produce at the end of the day with the rise of capitalism and its flourishing, became a space of fragmentation, of hybrid identities, and of muting many voices, which led to more violence. And if this violence is still seen as social violence, not as military violence, the question would then be, what difference does it make if the violence is social or military, political or considered to be social crime? The weight of trying to understand the burden that we bear to face such violence, and how to distinguish different spheres of violence and to deal with them with different tools or with the same tools, with different paradigm or with different with the same paradigm. These were questions at stake. I think that what Mary attempted in her part in the chapter to do, and what came out through discussion over what to write in the chapter, was that jihad was sort of liberated as a concept from the historical or the present burden of being equated with terrorism. Mary looked more into the tradition of jihad, into the moral restrictions posed by Islamic jurisprudence on the use of force, on the taboos and on the red lines, even in times of war, regarding killing civilians, regarding killing women, killing children, regarding protection and preservation of environment as well. So the pillars of civility, even in times of war, should be preserved in order for civility to flourish again, because war has always been seen in different traditions, and especially in the Islamic tradition, as an instant on a continuum of peaceful coexistence of human beings. So in order to enable civility to flourish again, how can we preserve a minimum of civility, or a minimal degree of civility that Martin Olbro talked about? I don't want to talk longer, but I think that the notion of preemptive civility is also a notion of recapturing the role of the citizen. We talk about civil society as an abstract entity. I mean, who is civil society? At the end of the day, civil society are the people who live in a specific society and who feel the urge to show solidarity, to protect the values and virtues they believe in, the civic virtues, to go out of their way even to campaign and to support causes of civility in other countries and in other places. So it boils down to the citizen at the end of the day. Sometimes when we extensively use the term of civil society, it just obscures this individual day-to-day choices that people make in order to protest, to debate, to protect, to foster, and sometimes even to act in their own individual life against what civility requires. Hence, we ended the chapter with mentioning different attempts by different societies to revisit again or to recapture again the role of the citizen in societies where associations and networks have been focused upon, and the individual sort of was lost on the way as a moral agent, especially when we talk about notions of civility in times of peace and in times of war. I think that I owe Mary a thank you, because actually writing the chapter together was a very existential experience for me. The questions she asked that were so simple regarding issues related to Islam, though I did not write these parts, but she kept sort of asking me some questions, allowed me to revisit again my different notions and see that how in different religious traditions war was only a tool and it was not an end in itself, but somehow the cause was twisted. But we can never do, and this is our dilemma at the end of the chapter that we discuss, we cannot say that pacifism is the only answer to aggression. Sometimes we have to set the priorities and to also say, when is civil society actually morally obliged to use force in order to protect civility? And these are the very controversial moments where there are very where there are many paradoxes, many risks to take, but also courageous decisions to be taken on the global civil society level. I hope that when you read the chapter, you will find some ideas that are worth looking into, and also these would raise questions for you to think and take along in your own personal and individual life day to day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, Heba did tell me what to read before I wrote the bits about jihad, so she was my teacher. Well, this is, as Kirsty said at the beginning, this is the sixth edition of our yearbook, and it has been actually a really fascinating project over a period of 6 years. It's actually involved a very large number of people, many of whom are here, but many of whom are not. We've had lots of meetings, we involve students, we involve activists, and you'll see if you look at the yearbook that there are very many different contributions from students and activists and others from different parts of the world. And it's really been a kind of learning process. I'd like to thank everyone who was involved this year. I'd like particularly to thank Martin, who is sitting in our institute as a retired person, and we dragged him into the discussions, and he made a really wonderful and important contribution. I'd like to thank my other co-editors, Marlies, who's here, and Helmut Anhaar, who's in America. And I can't thank everybody, but I would like to give a special thanks to Fiona Holland, who's our managing editor, and who actually succeeds in coordinating this enormously complex operation. And in addition, she makes the yearbook very stylish. I mean, it really looks very beautiful, and she's responsible for that. I think what's made it so fascinating is that, in a sense, what we're doing with this yearbook is not exploring a subject, global civil society, but exploring a new perspective. It's a way of thinking about contemporary issues, and a new way of thinking. And so it involves us constantly discussing all kinds of issues from a different perspective. And I think the two new elements of the perspective are, first of all, the emphasis on the global, by which I think what we really mean is probably not national. In other words, we don't mean physically crossing borders, although that's involved. We do mean a sense of consciousness that we live in a world rather than that we're bound by the borders of nation states, that we're part of a human community. But we also mean in political terms that we live in a world where the decisions that affect our lives are not just determined by our governments, or are not predominantly determined by our governments, but also by international institutions, by local institutions, by multinational corporations, and being involved in participating in that means addressing layers of institutions. But the other aspect, of course, is the emphasis on civil society, and for me what's important about that is the emphasis on agency. It's about how we affect and influence global processes. It's not about a deterministic description of how they happen. And I think we do, of course, in the yearbook, we endlessly discuss what global civil society means, and I'm not going to go into that discussion again. But what we do mean is we're talking about arenas and spaces where people try to influence those decisions that affect their lives. And whereas in the past those arenas and spaces were largely national, now, today, they're global in the sense that I meant before. In other words, they're global not simply in the sense of crossing borders, though they do. They're global in the sense of being concerned about global issues, even if you're concerned at a very local level about waste disposal. That's having something to do with global issues. So that's the first thing I wanted to say, was that we address a different perspective. As everyone's pointed out, the theme in this year's yearbook is violence and civility, although we do have great chapters on other subjects, which I want to mention, though not describe. One on economic and social rights, one on conflicts over water, and one which is great on football. Football as a space for global civil society. I want to talk really about the two chapters to which I contributed. And the first one is the one, of course, with Heba about violence and civility. Actually, Heber's talk reminded me of how we started with this, which is that we had a meeting in Cairo to discuss this issue. And what struck me was that the people from the Middle East and the people from the West, as it were preoccupied with quite different issues. We were preoccupied with, is it justified to use force for a humanitarian intervention? Is it justified to use force to prevent genocide or ethnic cleansing? And they were preoccupied with, is it justified to use force to end occupation? And what we realized is that both of them were actually preoccupied with using force to defend human rights, using force against oppressive primarily states. And what Heber and I realized when we came to write it was that we were prepared to see there were conditions, but how you use force is also extremely important, and I'll come back to that. But I think what I learned was, from all the reading Heber gave me to read, was what was fascinating for me was to discover that if you go back to classical Islam, that's the sort of high point of Islam in the medieval period, from when Muhammad lived until about the 14th or 15th century, during that period when there were huge debates about what was meant, there was a thinking that it was extremely similar to what later became in the West the Western Enlightenment. In both traditions, there was a distinction between the realm of peace, which in the Western Enlightenment was called civil society, and in classical Islam was called Islam, and the realm of war, or the state of nature, or the realm of ignorance, as it was sometimes called. And actually, the realm of peace was very similar. It was characterized by a political authority. It largely took place in cities. It was characterized by a social contract in both cases with the authority. It was characterized by the rule of law, which was interpreted by scholars who used their reason. And reason was understood in both cases as God's will imprinted on our consciousness. It was not any direct, you weren't told by God what was right or wrong, you had to work it out for yourself. So there was a huge similarity, and not only was there this similarity, before I go on to it, and in both cases, war was justified against foreign enemies. Not domestically, but in this state of nature against ignorant people, against, then war was justified. But even though war was justified, if the cause was just, if it was going to prevent aggression, for example, and in the Shia tradition, the only just cause was self-defense, there were very strict rules in both traditions about how you should use force. You weren't supposed to kill non-combatants. You were supposed to treat prisoners and hostages well. And one of the reasons we called our chapter Not Even a Tree is, and I'm looking for the quotation, is that we start with a quotation from Abu Bakr, who was the first caliph. It's a very famous quotation, actually. And these are the rules for Islam. Do not mutilate. Do not kill little children or old men or women. Do not cut off the heads of palm trees or burn them. Do not cut down the fruit trees. Do not slaughter a sheep or a cow or a camel except for food. And if you pass by the monasteries of believers who devoted themselves to worship, leave them to what they choose to do. So that's a very early period, and that shows very strict rules. Now, our argument is actually that both traditions had their limitations, because in both traditions the realm of peace was bounded and war was allowed against beyond the boundaries of the realm of peace. And so our argument is nowadays, in a globalized world, those boundaries don't exist. So we really have to rethink this. And we live in a world, actually, where we have two things going on. We have the war on terror and terror, which are both fought in the name of these two traditions, and yet neither of them obey these traditions. Neither the war on terror obeys the injunctions for bombing, certainly doesn't fit, I think, a lot of the presumptions of jus in bello, as it's called in the Western tradition, nor does notions of jihad justify, in no cases, it fascinatingly actually, this is a little diversion, but in the Christian tradition, before the period of the Western Enlightenment, there was a distinction between just war and holy war. Holy war was authorized by the Pope, and just war was authorized by political authorities. Because holy war was authorized by the Pope, who had a direct relation to God, you could fight a war without restraint. So when the Crusaders went to Jerusalem, they immediately massacred 25,000, or I think it was even 75,000 infidels. And that was okay because it was holy war. And one of the big achievements of the Enlightenment was to say, holy war is no longer legitimate. Wars authorized by political authorities had to be fought justly because the political authorities had to obey the rules that were laid down for just war. Now, the fascinating thing is that there's no such thing as holy war in the Islamic tradition because there's nobody with a direct relationship to God. So actually, the correct translation of jihad is not holy war, but just war. And that's something, so it's completely unacceptable to say that because this is a war for religion, you can kill anyone or undertake any kind of atrocity. So we said both traditions are being distorted, but in a global world, we have to rethink them, and we have to try to recover those notions of civility that were developed for the realm of peace, but we have to extend them. We live in a world where everybody is a Muslim, or everybody is a citizen. And so we have to rethink what civility means, and we have to extend it in a global sense. And we have to make it clear that actually war isn't justified. So it's not just that it's not justified not to kill civilians. It's actually that you can only ever use force in extremely limited ways, in the way that you might use force domestically to enforce the law, for example, rather than using force in the way that you did with war, where you were allowed to kill your enemy. But we could talk about that some more. I'm not going to say anything more. I just want to say very briefly, because I think I'm running after time, about the other chapter that I was involved in, which is about civil society in conflict. And I just realized as I was thinking about it today that actually the other chapter contradicts the first chapter. Because in our chapter on civil society in conflict, we say, actually, there's a sort of assumption that civil society is a good thing and that donors, Western foundations and governments think if we fund civil society, we can stop wars. And we say in this chapter, actually, civil society is anything but civil. There are people in civil society who are very strongly in favor of war and who argue for war. And we give the example, for example, of Serbia, where nationalists were arguing very strongly against for a greater Serbia, against Albanians, against Croats, against Muslims in the years preceding the war in Yugoslavia. So there are, in America, after all, the neoconservatives, apart the American Enterprise Institute, the people who argue for the war on terror, they're part of civil society too. There are also groups that try to manage conflict, and they don't. Sometimes they end up, lots of people are very keen on conflict resolution, on diplomacy, but often that ends up legitimizing parties to conflict. and strengthening extremists on either side. And then there are people who try to mitigate conflicts. There are humanitarian agencies who feed people in the middle of conflict. I'm not saying that's not a good thing, nor the conflict resolution, but that can have perverse effects in financing providing finance for the various warring parties and allowing conflicts to be prolonged. So there's no obvious reason why civil society should be a good thing. On the other hand, what we argue is it's always better to talk about things than to fight about things. And if you do have some kind of faith in reason, then you do come to the view that if there is a chance to talk about things, then you're more likely to end up with a peaceful solution. And then the final point we make is, but if you do make that argument, can you actually support civil society by giving it money? Actually, what a lot of Western donors do is to pour money into civil society and create kind of war profiteers, or peace profiteers, if you like. But actually, if you're really serious about civil society as an alternative to war, what's really important is to engage with civil society, to provide an opportunity where people can have access to decision makers, can put their views forward, can really feel that their discussions can influence the way the world operates. Well, that's really what I wanted to say about this year's yearbook. One chapter that I forgot to mention is a really wonderful chapter by Jenny Pierce on the relationship between domestic violence and political violence. And I think that's a really important issue, which is very much underdeveloped. I'm convinced there is a link between these two forms of violence, but it's actually very difficult to establish. And what Jenny does is to show how the kind of socialization within the family can also lead to violence in the streets. So that's worth reading. But other than that, I will stop there, and I hope you'll all ask lots of questions.
Well, thank you very much to all three of our speakers. We can take some questions now. Could you, before you ask your question, say who you are? And also, on the platform, we're supposed to repeat some of the questions so that it can be heard on the podcast. Have we got any questions? Who wants to be brave enough? This gentleman here in the third row, the microphone. And are there any others? Because I might take more than one at the same time. And you next, yeah.
My name is Patrick. I'm an LSE student. The question refers to Professor Calder's speech when she said she was in Cairo, that she realized that the West was primarily concerned over questions about is humanitarian intervention justified, and that in Egypt people were concerned about whether or not resistance to an occupation was justified. And humanitarian intervention and occupation are words that are... Occupation doesn't mean the same thing to two different sides, and so doesn't humanitarian intervention. So then it becomes a question of perspective. And so how do we go beyond the, you know, oft quote the cliche that one person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter?
My name is Luis. I'm a student here at LSE. I was intrigued by Professor Caldor's idea of the eradication or the elimination of boundaries of the between the domestic and the foreign, which is an idea I think that is very true to reality. But I was wondering what any of the panelists' thoughts were on how. What practical steps could be taken in terms of the institutional, political institutional frameworks that could be created in order to help realize the kinds of practices that supposedly civil society encourages, given specifically the entrenchment of the state in its national form today, and how do you overcome the resistance that the nation state will no doubt is creating to those forces and will create in the future, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, Mary, would you like to start? Just to recap on those two questions, one about the different perceptions to when violence is justified and whether one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter, and that second question there about what practical steps can be taken and the link between the domestic sphere and civil society.
Well, on the first question, it's something that I devote my life to thinking about. Let me say, first of all, that I've found the concept of human security is a really valuable concept in thinking about that, because when we think about legitimate violence currently, only the state has the right to use violence legitimately, and therefore we think about security as state security and the defense of borders. I think if we start to think about security as human security and the defense of individuals instead, then that's a very useful way to think about it. So that's the first point. The second point is that I do think that we learn from these two traditions, and actually they're very similar in this respect, certain rules for thinking about when violence is justified. First of all, there's the issue of just cause. Well, what I've said is I think the only situation where it's justified is one of a humanitarian catastrophe, or, as Heber put it, a crime against humanity. It is to defend people against a humanitarian catastrophe. And in Western just war thinking and in Islam, it's usually aggression. But I think aggression could be formulated in that way. Aggression is a humanitarian catastrophe. So I would start with that. The second thing is right authority. That's very important in both traditions. There must be a proper authority to authorize the use of force. And I think this is where we're changing. This is where a big change is happening, because when these ideas came up, there was what was decided was that private quarrels were unacceptable. So you couldn't have duels. But quarrels between states were legitimate. That was the difference between duellum and bellum. Bellum was legitimate and duellum was not. Well, I think quarrels between states are no longer legitimate. Bellum is no longer legitimate either. War is no longer legitimate. And so what we need now is some form of multilateral authority for the authorization of the use of force. And we could discuss that. It could be the UN or whatever. And otherwise, I think the only time you can use force is as in domestic law, which is in self-defense. And then the third thing is the tradition of just means, jus in bello, which I described in both cases. And I think that that has to be much more stringent. And fascinatingly, in Islam, there were very... Interestingly enough, if you distinguish between the Western and the Islamic traditions, in the Western tradition, you could be absolutely ruthless in putting down domestic quarrels because this was unacceptable. Domestic war was unacceptable. So when the peasants' revolt happened in Germany, Luther justified the most horrendous use of force to suppress the peasants. Interestingly enough, in the Islamic tradition, domestic quarrels among Muslims, you have to be much more strict than in external wars. So the rules, you can't kill a Muslim, even if he's attacking. So the rules domestically in the Islamic tradition are much more stringent. And so I would argue that we have to use those stringent rules that apply to policemen or that apply to domestic rules in Islam when force is used. So those would be my three conditions. Sorry, that was a very, very long answer. Then the second thing really relates to this, which is how do we have political institutions? I mean,
the emergence of civil society was completely linked to the emergence of states and authorities. But it was, in fact, up until the 19th century, civil society meant a society characterized by the rule of law. And it was only in the 19th century that we got the idea from Hegel that civil society was separate from the state, but it could only exist within the framework of a state. And I think likewise today, if we're really serious about global civil society, it can only exist because there is a framework of global rules. And just as civil society and the state, in a way, developed together, so I think that's happening now, that we're in the process of constructing a set of global rules, states, international institutions, and so on. And civil society is part of that process. But it can't exist, in my view, without that process. If we talk about civil society in conflict, it's only because there is an international set of rules that they can really exist, and a sort of international framework and form of communication.
Thank you, Mary. Heber or Martin, would you like to contribute to that?
I just have a small point to say that I think that, to put it in a very simplistic way, if religious traditions have been trying to limit the use of violence, force, power, whatever, in times of war, and restrict it with specific moral restrictions and restraints, if, as Mary mentioned, modern wars are by nature immoral, they do not respect these boundaries, they go and violate spaces, they put the bargain on actually vast devastation and shock, you know, as it said, how can you then defend them morally? How can you deal with them? And it's not that you say, don't use any force because you'll always have victims and you'll not be abiding by the moral restrictions, but the question would be what to do about the situation. And I think that this is a question posed not only to religious traditions that are struggling now to deal with modern wars that their tradition did not imagine in the first place. They always dealt with limited wars, always addressing the enemy outside the community. So the dilemmas were inexistent. I mean, it's a different situation. Now we want to apply moral dimensions on an immoral war by nature, which is the modernist war and use of weapons. So there is a dilemma here, and Mary's opinion was that the only way is to strive and to struggle so that we would not have wars, that use of force would not be legitimate unless in very specific cases where really communities are threatened, massive genocide, etc. While in other situations, the answer might be, and I don't think that there is one answer, the answer might be leave it to the communities that are under threat to use the force that they see defends them against the aggression that is taking place. And we can talk about the Lebanese war, the recent Lebanese war. If you see Hezbollah as basically communities defending in southern Lebanon their existence vis-a-vis Israeli aggression or Israeli occupation that has been lasting there for the 90s, with two wars before the war on Lebanon in the last round, but two wars have taken place between Israel and Hezbollah before. So how far can you actually leave it to the communities to decide? Because they are the ones at stake, and their lives at stake, their children are threatened, and they are the ones to decide when they want to take the weapons and defend their existence. So there are no straightforward answers. I think that the dilemma is as much posed on modernity as it is posed on religious traditions, in different traditions, to make sense, to save morality and the moral agent. Because at the end of the day, this is the agent that religions addressed to make more moral and to preserve his civility or her civility. So no straightforward answers. We are dealing with a very unprecedented situation where the heritage of understanding the limitations and boundaries of war is completely washed by this modern use of weapons and of massive destruction. So the dilemma is actually posed on both sides. The modernist use of force that promised to be civil proved not to be, and on religious traditions that wanted to be moralist are incapable of doing so sometimes.
Thank you. A lady here in the front row, and have we got another one that I can take at the same time? Yes, and the gentleman in the blue jumper at the back. Second.
My question is for Mary. I'm Charlotte Hallery from Radio Free Europe. Mary, you said that the only justified war is the war against those who commit crime against humanity. My question is that, do you consider, for example, Saddam Hussein's reign a crime against humanity, against Kurds, Shias? And secondly, do you consider 9/11 and 7/7 a crime against humanity or not?
I was just wondering, is it possible to foster a real sense of civil society in non-democratic regimes, or is democracy a prerequisite for encouraging a global civil society?
Thank you. Well, Mary, you again. I'll have to bring Martin in a moment. But can we start with that first question? Does Saddam and 9/11, would you claim those crimes against humanity?
I think both Halabja and what Saddam Hussein did against the Kurds and what he did against the Shias in 1991 were crimes against humanity. I think that as of 2003, it was very difficult to justify the invasion by arguing there was an impending humanitarian catastrophe. I think it would have been quite justifiable to go to the defense of the Shias in 1991. But I also think it should have, would, if it had been done, it would have had to be done very defensively rather than in order to defend them, rather than aggressively to do regime change. Not because I'm not in favor of regime change, on the contrary, I think it would have been wonderful, but because I think that can only really happen through a political process, effectively. And that's, in a way, what we've learnt as a result of the invasion of Iraq. Yes, I think both 7/7 and 9/11 were crimes against humanity, and I think if we treated them as crimes against humanity, we would have had a different kind of response and probably a more effective response. On democracy and global civil society, that is what we hope will be our theme for next year's yearbook. And in a way, the fascinating thing for me is that I got hooked on civil society through being very involved in the oppositions in Eastern Europe in the 1980s. Actually, it was the first time I'd heard civil society. Interesting for this generation, but somehow nobody talked about civil society except for a few Italian communists up until the 1980s, at least in Western Europe. So when I went to Eastern Europe to talk to dissidents, suddenly they were talking about civil society. And I think what fascinated me was that when I started to study the term and think about it, is that what they meant was something very different from what was understood historically. They meant they were much more anti-state than civil society theorists had been historically, but they were also much more transnational. For them, international human rights legislation was a tool to be used in their struggle against authoritarian regimes, and likewise support links with other civil society groups elsewhere. So what I think has happened, actually, is that the nature of democracy has changed, and we are, and as a result, you know, civil society can cross borders precisely because they have, if you like, tools, whether they range from the internet or from international human rights laws or whatever, that they can use in their domestic settings in a way that was very much more difficult in an earlier period.
Martin, do you think that what Saddam perpetrated against the Kurds and the Shia was a crime against humanity and a justification for war, and the same for 9/11?
Well, I think Mary's answered that, so I say yes. I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward. I mean, what is happening in the world with institutions is, of course, there are very dramatic changes afoot. I mean, it's only, I think, within the last year that the United Nations has accepted that crimes against humanity are a reason for intervening in other states. Remember, the United Nations was set up by countries, by states, effectively really saying, keep out of each other's business. So it really is a dramatic shift that's taken place in the last year or so. The other thing is the legitimation for war now has transcended the old rules. After all, we have now at the moment something that everyone will acknowledge is war happening in Afghanistan, where you have a multinational force now, NATO, pursuing a war against ill-defined opponents, but under United Nations authority. It is a mandate from the United Nations that that NATO is affecting. So this is really quite a dramatic development, I think, within institution building as far as global civil society is concerned. And certainly one would like to think that some of those things could have operated retrospectively. If only we could have insisted, the rest of the world insisted on the United Nations as the proper vehicle before the Iraq War, but wasn't able to do so. On the issue of democracy, can I say there, I do think, while it's true, and I might disagree slightly with Mary here, while it's true that civil society has depended upon the state, the kind of dependency it's had has been on the state providing fundamental basic security and not necessarily anything else. There's an awful lot that the contemporary state provides apart from security. It provides welfare, it provides education, it provides a whole range of other things. And the development of civil society, to some extent, is contesting what the state arrogated to itself through modernity. And we find, I think, in many of the impetuses towards more civil society activity and involvement, not quite an antinomianism on the part of an opposition to the state, but at least a basic feeling that something other than the state ought to work for the administration of society, that there are social ends which are not necessarily done through the state, and civil society itself, therefore, has a kind of grassroots mobilization to it, which, once it gets institutionalized in the form of NGOs and so on, then it loses its luster, it loses its appeal for those who are in it. And so we're seeing recursively out there young people, time and time again, as it were, trying to revive civil society by rejecting the existing kinds of institutions which that provide for it. So there is a kind of underlying turbulence with civil society, which is always, to my mind, in tension with state institutions. And you see this in the kind of transformations you get in the World Social Forums and the like. And I don't think we can discount this. It's democratic in the sense that it comes from the people, but it's not democratic in terms of established institutions, and that is one of the dilemmas for civil society, particularly for global civil society. And all civil society is potentially global because it does not accept that the state defines the boundaries of action. Once you reject the state as defining the boundaries of action and appropriate action in the world, that you're crossing boundaries and you're potentially global. So global civil society is the contemporary necessary development out of older national civil societies. Now, I don't know how far that represents a major disagreement with Mary.
I don't think it does.
You don't think it does? Okay.
I agree with it.
All right.
I probably didn't put the tension bit enough.
Got time for another couple of questions. This lady in the front row and the lady, a second question from the lady in the front row.
And
there's a gentleman up there, I'll take you third.
Hello. My name is Jessie Harrington. I wanted to ask you that it's a bit out of the subject, but it's, do we have enough resources in the world? And how should these global resources be shared? And if there aren't enough resources in the world, how can global civility be possible?
Lady with the black and white scarf.
Pauline Graham, are you not just developing different standards
of legitimizing violence by saying ethnic, it's all right to, you know, to go in to avoid ethnic cleansing or B or C or D.
And the gentleman in the balcony.
Yes, thank you. Very simple question. But does this panel delegitimize the jihad? And why? Thank you.
Does it delegitimize what?
Jihad. Heather, would you like to start? And start off perhaps on that third question.
I don't think that the panel attempts neither to legitimize nor delegitimize jihad. It's attempting to discuss issues of violence and civility in a global context and to acquire different or to implement different notions and concepts and try to synthesize them to come up with a vision about the dilemma we are facing. So it's not trying to legitimize or delegitimize, it's trying to re-civilize, if this makes any sense. And I mean, I think we have our own questions as well. We are not trying to make a statement as much as we are going, as we, Mary said, we are trying to address or reframe issues in a different way, which also might address the question of the lady in the front when you said if there are not enough resources, hence there is a potential for violence or for fighting over the limited resources we have. I think I again tend usually to think of things on the micro level. I mean, you cannot talk about generally like that and then legitimize war, because at the end of the day, people have to fight for survival, this sort of Darwinian notion. No, I think that it depends on the situation. What resources are you talking about? In what context? Who is taking what from whom? And what is the tool that they are using? Peaceful negotiation, splitting benefits, fighting and committing genocide. What are we talking about? I think the more concrete you are about the case you are talking about, then we can sort of distinguish what is just from what is unjust. The same for the question of the young gentleman earlier. A freedom fighter's person might be the terrorist of another. I mean, I can't just generalize. I can't generalize when I talk about that, but I can't sort of contextualize in a Palestinian context, in a Brazilian context, in a Tamilian context, you know, and then we can start looking into the history of the conflict, what every party did, how much they violated of basic notions of human rights and even laws of war, etc., and then pull it down to a concrete case. But talking generally like that does not really lead us anywhere.
Mary, could you address the second question of whether you're trying to set a different set of standards for when violence is legitimate?
Yes, I will. But I would like to say one little thing about jihad, which is that jihad actually means a struggle for what's right. So Heber will tell me when she's off to demonstrate about the war in Lebanon that she's off to do her jihad. And the point in Islam is that war is just if it's jihad, if it is a struggle to do what's right. But it doesn't mean that jihad is necessarily war. So I think that's important. Not Haber is, of course, right. We're not legitimizing or delegitimizing, and I'm not a Muslim. So, but I think, as I understand it from my Muslim friends, jihad doesn't have to mean war. So in that sense, it could be perfectly legitimate if it means going to demonstrate against the war in Lebanon, for example. On the new standards, yes, of course, we are setting new standards. I mean, it wasn't historically justified. When we went to war against Germany in the Second World War, we didn't go to war because he was killing Jews. We went to war because he attacked other countries. And so, yes, we are saying there are different standards nowadays, although we would but we are specifying what those standards are, and those standards are massive violations of human rights. It's a form of self-defense. That's what I think is legitimate, or to defend third parties. That seems to me to be the legitimate use of force. And on the resources, I mean, that is a huge question, but I think the only point I'd really like to make about that is that I do think that human beings are very ingenious and can find ways to save on the use of resources, to try to develop sustainable and other technologies. But if that's to happen, you need an active global public debate. You need people who will campaign about it. And that's really why it's terribly important to talk about civil society, to talk about the environmental movements, to talk about the ways in which our lives can be changed to deal with problems of resources. And in a sense, that's one of the many issues that we may address in the yearbook, but we will address it from this perspective.
Martin?
Yeah, on resources, not on the other question. Yes, we have enough resources. It's a question of how they're distributed. Here I think everyone has to respect Amartya Sen's contribution here. Most analyses of the global economy would suggest that if we attended to distribution of resources, then we could solve poverty. I might say on this, going back to my favorite thinker of tonight, Samuel Johnson. Johnson famously said the true test of civilization of a country was how it treated its poor people. And this is in the 18th century. I think it applies equally now. The true test of global civilization is how we handle the question of poverty.
Well, we've got 5 minutes left, so we can probably squeeze in about two more questions. This gentleman here in the brown T-shirt. Anyone else before I give you a stick? You've already had a shot, haven't you? No? Okay, and another one from the lady in the front row.
Hello, I'm Adam Knowles. I'm an undergraduate student of International Relations at the Open University. I just wanted to explore, direct a brief question to Martin Olbrow on the concepts of minimalist universalism and what would be included in that. Specifically, the one thing you did mention was reason. Now, it may be a personal view, but you could say that the very definition of faith requires the suspension of reason. So is secularism a requirement of a minimalist universalism, and what else would you include in that?
And we'll take another question just quickly.
One question is maybe from Dr. Ezzat, who a couple of times you referred to the concept of terrorism and freedom fighters and said that freedom fighters of one country are terrorism of the other. Isn't it the time that in the climate of delegitimizing violence, we condemn the freedom fighting through violence means, violent means?
Martin, would you like to start with minimalist universalism first? And then
happy yes, yes. This is a good question, because the whole point about the debate about the Enlightenment and its contribution to modernity has been a confusion. That is, a confusion between, if you like, the technical rationality which developed around the Enlightenment and since, which does lead, if it's directed without any moral consideration, to things like concentration camps, technical rationality, and then the issue of reason. Reason is something quite different. And Voltaire was insistent on this point, for instance. Reason is not the systematizing of thought. It's not producing engines. Reason is something else. And the point about reason is it always reaches a point, yes, where you can't reason further, and you either agree to differ, or you say, you know, this is what I believe, this is my faith. Ultimately, reason is grounded in unreason. And from that point of view, Voltaire's and Johnson's resolution of this problem, which was debated at length at that time, was rather different. Voltaire's solution was anti-clericalism. Johnson's was, well, look, we've got a church which is pretty stupid, really, in the Church of England, but at least it works. It's something that people can abide by. The traditional justification for the state of for the Anglican Church was not that it provided the actual way to God, but that it was the best kind of church you could have, given that having some kind of faith was very important for society. So there were these kinds of secularist justifications, even on the part of this old Tory, Samuel Johnson. But the minimalist universalism, I personally think it's quite a good phrase to express what happens in the Enlightenment. I don't think it's adequate for the world today. I much prefer, actually, the notion of pragmatic universalism, which is this: to accept that within every culture there is an assumption that some things can be true and possibly universally true. When you cross cultures, however, the universal truths of one culture meeting up with the universal truths of another culture cannot necessarily be resolved, but they're resolved actually in the encounters and practices of people meeting each other. And a pragmatic universalism is one which respects the fact that other people have universals, that we all seek universals in our lives, and we're never sure that we've got them. And it's we therefore have to be modest and tolerant vis-a-vis each other's universals. That's a pragmatic universalism, which is slightly different from the minimalist universalism, which I think is a fair characterization of the Enlightenment and not the kind of doctrinaire rationality which is sometimes projected back into the Enlightenment. We've got to demodernize the Enlightenment, take the Enlightenment out of modernity, if you like, and recognize what it contributes to reason in general.
Thank you. Heber, is it time to condemn freedom-fighting people?
I think it's time to condemn the state and its use of violence against everyone. And I think that you cannot understand the responses of those who call themselves freedom fighters anywhere in the world unless you understand the devastating use of force and violence and weapons of mass destruction on communities that actually produced those freedom fighters. So my concern is the state. I will not try to be apologetic. I will not try to be defensive of any use of force by the state against citizens under any circumstances, under any reason, calling them terrorists, calling them ethnic groups that are asking for separation. What has been proven during the times of modernity is that the state has been the most criminal actor regarding the use of violence. And then if we work on that and see how we can stop this machine of reproducing these catastrophes and these genocides and these holocausts, then we can think about the other issue.
Except, Heber, can I just add, you would also...
I didn't finish my sentence.
Oh, good. I finished. I just wanted to...
This is the macro level. The micro level is you go to people who see their house demolished, who see their children killed, who see their innocent fellow citizens and neighbors bombed, and talk to them about pacifism. I think it's easy to talk about at LSE, it's difficult to talk about in streets of different cities that are subject to what I say. And I have a problem, a moral dilemma, personally, of trying to address those people with some of the ideas I have when I'm faced by that brutal reality. At the end of the day, people who say, if they kill our children, we will kill their children. My argument is I cannot do that personally. If my child is killed, I would be very hesitant to kill another person's child because of the morality of war that I'm talking about. But this is what I believe. Whether this is feasible humanly that you would do as a mother in the streets of Gaza, I don't know. I'm not in a position to give you political statements. But I have moral concerns. And I think that you will find them in the chapter scattered in different parts.
But I was going to add to say at the same time you do condemn the killing of civilians, whether it's from non-state actors or from the state.
Yes. And the problem is not condemnation. The problem is not how to condemn. The problem is how can we prevent? The problem is the prevention, not the condemnation. How can you make sure that civilians would not be killed but justice would be achieved? How can you allow freedom fighters to struggle but allow civilians to live in peace in safe areas and safe havens, as in Bosnia-Herzegovina, for example? So the questions are very complex. I mean, it's not enough to say, I condemn, I agree, I disagree, but how to prevent violence from continuing, or even what we called for preemptive civility, to prevent it even from taking place through long processes of negotiation, multilateral sort of intervention, before war erupts, etc.
If I can just add one thing, which is that one of the people who was at our meeting in Cairo, Lucy Nusabe from Jerusalem, she does argue a pacifist case, saying that resistance to occupation should be undertaken non-violently. And she argues it not simply on moral grounds, but on practical grounds, that it won't provoke responses. That violence always produces a more violent reaction. And she has a little box in our chapter putting forward her argument.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, so it just remains for me to... yes, sorry, I know we could go on, but I've been told to wind up at 8 o'clock and we're 5 minutes over that. So I'd just like to thank our speakers tonight, Heber Rauf-Ezat, Martin Olbro and Mary Calder, and all of you for your contributions. Thank you very much.